ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Rick Lane. Rick has worn many hats in his career. He's the executive producer of the documentary film, A Most Beautiful Thing, and a strategic advisor. Prior to this, he was the SVP of Government Affairs at 21st Century Fox and News Corporation, where for over 15 years, he was responsible for coordinating the development and implementation of the company's public policy activities. He's an expert on the future of work, which explores the disruption of our economy as a result of the fourth industrial revolution, encompassing a range of new technologies that are fusing the physical, digital, and biological worlds, impacting all disciplines, economies, and industries for which everyone should be prepared. And it's this area of change, tech and regulation, that we're going to focus on during our conversation today. Rick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You have a pretty diverse background, but for the purposes of today's conversation, we're going to focus on tech policy issues. And specifically, I want to zero in on Section 230 of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which might be the one and only thing that the two presidential candidates agree on. First, for listeners who aren't familiar with it, could you describe what it is?
To the best of anyone able to describe what 230 is, but Section 230 was part of the 1996 Telecommunications Act. The goal was, in the early days of the internet, was to create safe harbors for then AOL, CompuServe, and Prodigy to be able to moderate their sites without facing the risk of liability. There were two court cases, a Prodigy case and a CompuServe case. One of the cases treated the platforms like a publisher. And when they were moderating, when CompuServe was moderating, they were deemed to be a publisher and held liable, even though they were trying to do the right thing. Prodigy, on the other hand, was treated more like a bookstore. And basically the idea or newspaper stand was that they didn't have knowledge of what was going on. And therefore, just like a bookstore or a newspaper stand back in the days of folks who remember newspaper stands, the news person selling newspaper can't be held liable for what's in the newspaper themselves. So Chris Cox and Ron Wyden, House members at the time, came up with this idea to have a provision that would create a legal incentive for platforms to moderate without being held liable for what was being posted. There was also another piece of the Communications Decency Act, was known as the Exxon Amendment, which was to create filters in libraries and schools and other technological solutions because of the concern of rampant pornography and child pornography, and that there would be filters that would be mandated. That part of the CDA was shot down by the Supreme Court on First Amendment grounds. So what is left is this immunity provisions for platforms not to be held responsible for what users post. It provides immunity from state criminal law as well as civil law. They still can be held for federal criminal law, but it really has not been used that much because most of criminal and civil law happens at the state level.
Right. Now, a couple of things. So first, there is a legal incentive to moderate in terms of we're not going to prosecute you if you're paying attention. But there wasn't a demand to moderate,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's the big flaw in the bill that groups that I volunteer my time for, the anti-human trafficking survivor groups, as well as other groups that are out there, that's what they're focusing on. The example is that if I have a social networking site and I want to roll out a new product or service, I know that I can roll that out and not suffer any type of civil litigation or state criminal investigations for that product or service as long as it's user generated content. So therefore, I'm not going to build it in a way that may protect people because I can't be held harmless. Perfect example is Reddit, right? Reddit has subreddits, and each of the subreddits are moderated by a volunteer. The reason that they're able to moderate it by a volunteer is because if somebody does something horrible on the subreddit, Reddit can't be held liable. So they have no economic incentive or legal incentive to actually hire people to moderate. And that's great for the Reddit business model, because if you can have volunteers take and not have to pay them, it's wonderful. But the downside is if I'm a moderator of a subreddit and I don't care if bad things are happening on my subreddit and I don't report it, then they can continue to go on and Reddit has no responsibility. And that creates a disincentive for them to fix the problem.
Right. Well, question for you. Back in the day of newspapers, one of the ways newspapers used to make a lot of money was the classified section. And you could have some dodgy stuff happening in classifieds. Were newspapers liable for that?
It depends. Again, it's remember what 230 has allowed is for to block at the courthouse steps the ability to find out if they were doing shoddy things. That gets into the question of Backpage.com. So Backpage.com was facilitating sex trafficking, especially of younger children. They were helping place the ads, keywords used for the ads, telling these people how to do everything to basically sell these children. When there was civil litigation brought against Backpage.com, the court said they can't be held responsible. We can't do any due diligence to find out if they were knowingly facilitating sex trafficking. And therefore, they were off the hook and making $500 million a year. When we passed FOSTA-CESTA, that held them to be accountable for their actions. So you can find out if they're illegally engaged. What ended up happening with Backpage is after a Senate investigation, they found that they were knowingly facilitating sex trafficking of minors. And they went, before FOSTA-CESTA was passed, they had indictments against them. But the only way to figure that out or find that out was a Senate investigation. And you can't do that for every site. So in a newspaper, a newspaper, they don't have the 230 protection. So if they were somehow knowingly facilitating illegal activity, at least you could find out and you wouldn't be blocked at the courthouse steps. Section 230 helps Craigslist and others have no responsibility because you can't even get to the point, are they knowingly facilitating illegal activity?
But has CEDA 230 been amended by SESTA-FOSTA such that that kind of behavior can be found out? Or is it still, you can't find out?
It's narrowly targeted towards sex trafficking and not other illegal activities. So if a web...
Oh, so if you're a terrorist, for instance, or if you're planning on, crossing state lines and mixing it up with protesters.
Right. Or if you're helping facilitate illegal drug sales and you know that they're on your site, like
right.
On Facebook and TikTok, on Instagram, on Snapchat, there's a ton of illegal drug sales going on. It's easier to buy drugs online than offline in today's world. And they are not held responsible. They don't have to do anything to take it down. It's a PR problem for them, but it's not a legal problem for them.
Well, that's interesting. So it isn't, there's sort of this fiction, that bad stuff happens on the dark web. This is happening on the sunshiny web. This is happening on social platforms. This is happening. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. The dark web is the web now. And you add that, we don't have to get into the encryption debate, but if you add that 230 encryption, cryptocurrencies, all of a sudden what you've created is the web being the dark web because you can't see what's happening. So the web every day is getting darker and darker, even though it's the web we all use today.
Is that so? In a way, because so much of what's happening is happening on these platforms, and the platforms are obscured. Is that really how to understand it?
Yes. The platforms, first of all, have the protection, so you can't bring a civil litigation. A lot of cases, from intellectual property protection to the sex trafficking cases, some usually start at a civil level, right? And then they gather evidence, and then they hand it over to prosecutors. And that's how a lot of these illegal cases develop. But if you can't investigate because of 230 protections, because they can't be held civilly responsible, you know, they have no civil liability, then you never have these investigations to begin with. So what is happening is we have tons of evidence of illegal activities happening on these sites like Facebook and others, from not just raising money for terrorist activities, but the selling of antiquities to raise money for terrorist activities, the selling of exotic animals and endangered species. You have a whole host of illegal activities that are on Facebook that have been well documented, yet they have zero legal responsibility for that activity.
So if they are notified about an illegal activity, they are made aware of it, they still have no liability, having been informed?
Yes, unless it's copyright. Unless it's a Disney movie. Then they...
well, yeah.
then they're in trouble.
Then the problems come out.
Why, you know, because under Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is sort of the other side of the coin of 230, they are responsible. If they are notified that there's a copyrighted work on their site, they have to take it down, right? And they also can lose their DMCA immunity. 230 doesn't have any of that. In fact, one of the biggest complaints with some of the groups that I work with, especially on the antiquity side and the endangered species side where these are happening, is when they are notified, they may take them down. They also destroy all the evidence, right? They don't hold it and give it to law enforcement. They say, oh, you're right, this is horrible, and we're just going to shut it down, and then that evidence is lost. And they're not responsible for that. You know, in a normal circumstance, you can't destroy evidence.
So they aren't even responsible for destroying evidence. So they have absolutely no responsibility, no accountability, and they make money off of it.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, obviously there's some nuances.
I mean,
there.
Really, that's what it boils down to. And in fact, I mean, what it boils down to is there's a negative incentive to change
there,
it.
There is.
It seems
there. That's been the problem. That's why there's the growing chorus, as you mentioned at the outset, where Biden and Trump, the only policy issue, there's only two policy issues they agree on, which is TikTok is a national security risk and Section 230 should be repealed. I don't think it should be repealed. I think the safe harbor to encourage them to moderate should be retained. But we can make other changes to it that create this other incentive for them to be proactive in taking things down or be held accountable for not taking what we would call a duty of care approach.
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought up TikTok because this is something which you have to take sort of through the journey to understand why it's an issue or how this Communications Decency Act relates to U.S. security. I mean, that's a big leap, right? Decency, security.
Yeah.
So getting there, well, exactly. And so getting there, I guess, for users, to take them on the journey. Why does TikTok's ability to rely on this create cybersecurity issues or just security issues for the United States?
Sure. Obviously, we all know that TikTok is a Chinese company that has folks who run it are part of the Communist Party. Those are facts. Look it up in Wikipedia. Look it up on the internet. But the question becomes, if the Chinese government is using TikTok to manipulate U.S. public opinion, And they're using it to disrupt and create and incite violence in some way. TikTok itself cannot be held responsible for that because they are not, quote, the creator of the user-generated content. It would be the Chinese government. And so you would have to go after the creator, the person who created the user-generated content, which would be the Chinese government. That's not obviously going to happen. But
can I just jump in here? Because we don't have to go to TikTok. I mean, we've got Facebook. We have Russian interference in the U.S. election, right? And so these... I guess the question is, I know I had read one of the pieces you wrote and around the Trump campaign, the TikTok Gen Z inflation of Trump ticket sales to one of his big events, and that this really sort of made the penny drop for you. And what I was thinking when I read that was, well, wasn't that just a failure on the part of the Trump campaign to clean their own data? Is it a tool problem, or are people in the case of ticket purchases or faux ticket purchases, those are people being independent actors. Now, obviously, you've got military information support operations where they shape opinion through, understanding of behavioral sciences and the network effect on social platforms. But isn't this really a larger issue with surveillance capitalism in general? And will regulations, does it only apply to TikTok, or is it that this actually needs to apply across the board to any of these large social networking platforms?
It needs to apply across the board. It's not just a TikTok problem. The interesting thing, though, is TikTok has an interesting perspective on U.S. politics, as does the government that supports these types of companies. But you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, you had during the 2016 election, Facebook being paid in rubles for political ads. If that doesn't send up, I can't imagine the Washington Post, which would be held responsible and could be, or the Wall Street Journal, all of a sudden, and the broadcast networks, which have huge regulations on political advertising, accepting rubles for political advertising, and not saying that this may be a problem for us, because there is no responsibility by the platforms in addressing the ads. The fact that Facebook is taking this voluntary, I think it was a 2-week, you're not able to place political ads for 2 weeks before the election, is interesting, but that's because they have decided to do that. There's nothing that requires them to do that. You had senators that were trying to pass legislation to hold the platforms responsible for political ads. And that legislation has not seen the light of day, even after we know that the Russians were trying to interfere, the Iranians are constantly trying to do it, as well as the Chinese. And so it's just this crazy idea that somehow, because it's an online platform, that it should be immune from common sense and traditional law, which includes this idea of duty of care.
Right. Well, and at what point do you become a publisher? I mean, it goes to sort of the, does it walk like a duck, talk like a duck?
Right.
Is it a duck or not? Because they certainly, the platforms generate revenue the way digital publishers do. Question, if you are the New York Times and you have a digital site, are you responsible for the content on your digital site? Sure, what's in the paper is you're responsible, but are you also protected or not?
So that's one of the talking points for my friends on the other side of 230. This helps protect the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times on their digital platform. It only truly helps them in the user-generated comment section, but not on the articles themselves. because they are a publisher. You can't say that the piece that's being published, they can be held liable for what's placed on their platform because they are the publisher. This only helps them on the curated part of the user-generated content. But again, if you look at the difference, and they do moderate. I mean, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, I can't put up horrendous things on there. It may go up for a second, but they have people who will take it down instantly. You don't have that same incentive that is being done. And again, if we're looking at a duty of care, I would argue that the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the LA Times, and the Washington Post would fall within a duty of care. Someone trying to say, oh, they are inciting violence or their platform is being used in a way that they knowingly are creating harm or helping, I've never seen an illegal drug ad in a user comment in the Washington Post, right? But I can find a ton of those on Facebook and TikTok and Instagram and Snapchat and Twitter. So, yes, on one, there's a narrow slice where 230 can be helpful. But, as I was talking to somebody when we were talking about FOSTA SESTA, who was a big media company, and they said, I was like, are you going to oppose us on this because of the user-generated content? And the comment to me was, if we are violating what's in this bill, we should go to jail.
Well, that's an interesting position because you do get to a place where you're like, well, hang on, you're okay with this? This is okay with you as a business to do this stuff. Then there's also a question of because they're independent businesses and they're not being monitored or they're not liable for what their users do. Are they also free to say, we are not going to have XYZ kind of users? Is that, could they decide if they wanted to, we're going to get rid of, if we decide maybe right, maybe wrong, that you look like you're selling illegal drugs, we're just going to get rid of you. And it's a private business and we're going to ban you from our platform. Bang. Could they do that, or would they run into sort of free speech access, or is that within their power and they're choosing not to exercise it?
So it is within their power. I think that's where there's the differences on hate speech and freedom of speech. What we focus on is on conduct, right? What is the conduct of the entity that is placing it? So if you're engaged in illegal activity, that's a conduct. The platform can take you down. I do not believe in the idea of a fairness doctrine for the internet where you have to allow both sides to have an opportunity. Just as I don't believe that the AMC theater has to show adult entertainment. That's not censorship. That's not hindering free speech if they're only showing up to R-rated movies. That's a private business making a choice of what they want their clientele. Right. So I think that is all protected within the First Amendment. But when you get to the conduct of sites and the conduct of what is being placed, and it is illegal activity, there is no First Amendment right to engage in illegal activity. I can't sell drugs in a bar and get arrested and claim you're stifling my freedom of speech. This is a First Amendment issue because I'm selling drugs. It just, in any other business, you don't have, there's no free speech protection to engage in illegal activity. But
I guess the question is the bar liable for you selling drugs there?
If they're knowingly facilitating and it's a known drug haven, yes, it can be held responsible. Just like a hotel can be held responsible if they're knowingly engaged in sex trafficking and prostitution. I can't open up my hotel and say, and I know that there's, gambling going on and say, I'm not responsible. I'm just the owner of the business. You are held responsible. I can't open a, let someone else use my ballroom to open a casino. Why can that happen online? And that's what we're trying to get to is that the platforms are the only area where, in business, where they're just free from, illegal activity happening with the use of their their sites and knowingly that's happening.
Right. So getting back to sort of where we started the conversation, what is the status right now of either amending or eliminating 230, this immunity?
So in a completely divided Congress in an election year, any legislation is
dead in the water.
Not necessarily dead, but it creates obstacles, right? Because everyone's trying to game the system. But normally what happens for entities, because usually most issues are partisan in a way. And so your hope is that your candidate for president, will be elected who supports your view or won't be elected. And if they oppose your view. And in this case, what's really interesting is it doesn't matter who the presidential candidate is going to be or the presidential whoever becomes president, because both agree that 230, the status quo of 230 is not acceptable and needs to change. So they're stuck.
Is there a difference in how they, is there a difference? I understand why nothing is going to happen until after the election, simply because
I never give up. I'm always one of those ones who believe that until the gavel comes down, anything is possible. But it definitely makes it harder.
Is there a difference in how they would approach it? Would one side? Do you understand the parties have a nuanced difference in how they would change it?
Well, I think not really. And I say that because if you look at the executive order that came down from the president and that the FCC is currently looking at now, there's a lot of emphasis on the right on conservative bias, right? That's sort of the catchphrase that they look at and what their concerns are. And then on the Democratic side, it is much more on the conduct side. But if you talk to members individually, what I always call the Venn diagram of policy is that they both agree that the 230 complete impunity that 230 provides the platforms is not acceptable. And so I think we can get to a place where there is agreement on how to fix it. You always do run into the issue of the free speech First Amendment issue and everything that we're looking at, we're trying to avoid that. We don't want to have a CDA type of situation, but I think we can get there.
That goes to the earlier question I had around getting rid of like eliminating the membership capacity for certain voices if they're deemed to be doing something that the platform just doesn't like platform decided it doesn't like people who like purple, and they can decide to get rid of people who don't like purple because they're a private business and they can do what they want to do. And how the position of conservative bias or anti-conservative bias, I guess, that would fly in the face of that, that right of the private business to do what it wants to do, to not extend membership, to eliminate membership, to say user-generated content that does XYZ is not allowed. These are sort of terms of use, restricting terms of use, which is very different from the conduct conversation. I guess the question I have is that conduct conversation part of both parties' interest, or is the conduct conversation really only one?
It's part of both. That's where the overlap comes in on the conduct side.
That's where
you have a Senator Manchin talking about illegal drug sales. The question he asked, Twitter, Dorsey, and Facebook. It was one of the best questions ever asked on the illegal drug sales on their platforms. In agreement with other members on the Republican side about the illegal conduct. So, there's a quote that Scott Cleland had about this. It's one of my favorite quotes that he just put out. It says, "America is the only country that legally protects platforms from people, but not people from platforms." And I think that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where we are, and that can't be the policy of the United States. And unfortunately, it currently is.
It's interesting. It is a protection of not just platforms, but also property, because copyright is protected. So it's really just not people. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that there's revenue is being protected. The ability to earn ad revenue, the ability to earn drug revenue, the ability to earn child trafficking revenue, but not the ability to object. Something.
Well, what really has happened, you know, if you look at 96 and the business models, you know, that people like Jill Lesser from AOL, who's the point person, Peter Harder for Netscape, and even Jerry Berman, who created the Center for Democracy and Technology, CDT, you know, and all of us working back in the business model was subscription based. There was no online advertising. And the argument that was made by the business community at the time was, look at, you know, we, in order for us to have big successful businesses, we are going to have an economic incentive to keep our sites clean. We're going to work to keep people off because we want to have as many subscribers on our site that are not offended. It's very similar to the way the broadcast networks, you know, if they go over the line, you have the FCC stepping in and the Janet Jackson issue, right? And so there were always guardrails. But when the business model went from subscription base to advertising and then to targeted advertising, the economic incentives to clean up your site went away. Because the example, and it's, you know, an example that I, you know, it's a tough example, but it's a real example, which is, if I want to sell white sheets on a social networking site, and the social networking site says, I have 20,000 users who are interested in white sheets, to the platform, those 10,000 could be newlyweds who are buying white sheets for their new condo or house, and the other 10,000 are white supremacists. But I have 20,000 right. people I can target who are interested in white sheets. So the economic incentive is to have as many people on your platform as possible, no matter what they're doing. And that dynamic right. has created the dilemma and the problems that we see today. And then when you have algorithms that are not only directing advertising to individuals who are interested in white sheets, but then you're able to connect people who are interested in white sheets for different reasons and connect them together and start pushing them all into one area, is where we have the social unrest that we see today across the spectrum.
Right. Well, do you see lobbying are the platforms lobbying against changing these protections?
They're spending millions. They right. just launched a new, I think it's called America Innovation, that's led by NetChoice and the Internet Association and CTA and Google and Facebook and others. They are all over the hill lobbying on this. You know, they're pushing, including CDA 230 into our trade agreements. They were successful in the USMCA. I don't think they'll be successful in the other ones. Mostly because the Europeans mm-hmm. don't want it, and the UK. So CDA is Silicon Valley's top legislative priority. They're investing millions of dollars into lobbying against it. They created a new organization to focus on these issues. They have done, at least in the past year now, 30 different events that on why 230 is the most important piece of law written since the Ten Commandments. They can't be changed, just like you can't change the Ten Commandments. And they are all over the hill. They are spending money on advertisements. It's just a massive effort. You go on to Reddit and they're using their platforms to talk of why 230 should not be changed. So it is a massive effort. The unfortunate thing for folks that I work with, which are the anti-human trafficking and survivor groups, is we don't have those kind of resources. You know, we can't flood.
Well, sure. And they're manipulating public opinion.
And they're manipulating the algorithms, right? You know, just do a search on FOSS Assessed or 230. I ask your users to, if they're on a computer now, look it up and you'll see at least 90% to 95% of the first page and possibly the second page is all anti, you know, what or pro 230 and anti changes.
That is fascinating. That is fascinating. Well, we've run through our time, and I thank you so much for sharing so much time with us about this issue. I think it's something that is going to continue to unroll, and we'll have to continue to see how that impacts democracy. I don't know, small thing. But thank you so much for sharing the time. It's been great.
Well, thank you for having me. And I look forward to future conversations on this issue and other issues that are going to have a direct impact on the future of the internet. And for those of us who care about a safe, secure, and sustainable internet, we have a lot of fights ahead of us with Silicon Valley. And we're going to need allies.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking with you again next time right here on Up Next.